Welcome to the MS Dev Show, episode number 162. This week we talk with James Clark about Fluent Design, 27,000 errors in the Tizen operating system, and the insane list of top-level domains.
Raygun gives you complete visibility on errors, crashes, and performance problems affecting your end users. Replicate issues in seconds rather than digging through log files or having to rely on users to report errors or crashes. Raygun gives you a window into how users are really experiencing your software applications. Check it out today at raygun.com. This episode of the MS Dev Show is brought to you by Espose, the market leader of .NET and Java APIs for file business formats. Natively work with DocX, XSLX, PPT, PDF, MSG, MPP, image formats, and many more.
This week we have James Clark. He's a lead program manager on the Windows UI platform team, where he works on the effects and animation engine that powers Microsoft's new Fluent Design system. James holds a Master of Science degree in computer and telecommunications engineering from Surrey University in the UK. And I noticed that your bio is completely different than last time. Last time it said that you were a wannabe boosted board owner. So we have to update that. So what's the current status there?
Well, the current status there is, I think we chatted about this last time I was on the show, and you very kindly offered to let me try yours out.
Yep.
So we indeed did this last week. Mm-hmm. And the experience was so fun that I ordered one, and it actually showed up yesterday. So I'm now not a wannabe owner, but I'm an actual owner. So
yeah, how long did it take to wipe that smile off your face? Because man, you was just going.
Well, my credit card bill certainly.
Yeah. Oh, when you had to pay the bill. Yeah, that's the downside. I didn't even think to mention this. So I'll mention this now, and hopefully this doesn't make you cry. I don't know if you saw that there's a company that I think this is a little scummy, but they basically took the booster board, like ripped it off, and they made a version that's like half the price. It's like 90% as good. I still think you made the right choice though, because I don't know, I hit the limits of mine, and if mine was 10% worse, I would be very unhappy. So I still think you made the right choice.
I'm a big fan of Casey Neistat, and I watched that comparison review of the sort of slightly less good one, and I just thought, yeah, okay, great. I'm, you know, these people were the pioneers. I'm going with the pioneers.
Yeah,
you know?
I mean, it was just a blatant ripoff of the hardware. So,
yeah,
it's good to encourage the pioneers that they're actually doing like the R&D and really know what they're doing.
Yeah, and the quality is amazing. Like it's really, you know, the deck is like bamboo, and it's I'm very impressed. Very solid.
Thing is, it's like, you know, not to go on like a tangent, but the thing is, what the board I think actually sits like 4 inches off the ground, or maybe even something like 4 inches. You can push your foot, and I don't know if you've done this, but push your foot in the middle, and you can touch it to the ground. That board will bend that much. It's pretty wild how strong that bamboo is. So now our next challenge is to get together and ride somewhere. Once you get a little bit faster, that way I don't have to spin, you know, go in circles around you.
Yeah.
Couple weeks though, man, it was like 3 days and I was going, you know, 15, 20 miles an hour. So.
Yeah. I'm still on the kind of beginner setting, and I'm sort of standing there shaking away going, you know, please don't fall off.
But yeah.
It's super fun.
Stage two is that your legs are going to be in a lot of pain. And then eventually, because your muscles get like so seized up, but then it'll get easier.
Yeah.
So anyway, let's jump into the comment of the week, Carl.
This comment we pulled off of iTunes. It was from Doug Mayer, and he says, "I have been listening to your podcast from the beginning. Continue listening because I enjoy getting information straight from the source. Thanks again, Doug."
Awesome.
And yeah, that's one of the things we try to do. We try to get the people that either create it or work directly with it at such a level that they know it as well as the creators. And that's one of the things that we strive to do on the show. So thank you for noticing. Thank you for listening. And thank you for the 5-star iTunes review. And if you want to get mentioned on the show like Doug, send us an email to feedback@msdevshow.com, comment on Facebook, YouTube, or Stitcher. We especially love 5-star iTunes reviews like Doug's.
Mm-hmm. Definitely helps us out. Okay, let's jump in the news. 27,000 errors in the Tizen operating system. That doesn't sound like a lot.
Yeah, so this was done. They kind of did some static analysis, and you can kind of debate the merits of that, but you know, they kind of took some choice pieces of code found a bunch of errors and kind of extrapolated out through the rest what that would be. And well, that's kind of interesting of itself. You know, I didn't really think it was too newsworthy until a few days later. There was another blog post by these same people, and they say, we continue exploring Tizen. There's some C-sharp components in there. And by like some, there's like, I think they found like 200 C-sharp projects. Mm-hmm. And they said those components are really high quality and have, like, in comparison, a much, 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 much lower error rate, according to the static analysis.
So this is deja vu, because, and I had to search for this article because I couldn't remember the number. So have you heard of this other article? So this was in the year 2000. Windows 2000 has over 65,000 bugs. Have you guys heard of that?
I remember something about that.
So it was 65,000. So it was this thing, you know, because it basically somebody got a hold of it, some internal memo, and it was basically from a bug tracking system. You know, guess what? Bug tracking systems keep track of a lot of these. So it sounds like this Tizen thing is different because, like you mentioned, they actually looked at actual issues in the code instead of like what was in their bug tracker. Is that correct?
Exactly. Yeah, they did static analysis.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, that certainly does make it a little bit more significant and worrying.
Well, it's good news that C-sharp is helping them out, though, I have to say.
Yeah. No, it's, the .NET team is doing some really awesome stuff, and there's even more insanely awesome stuff to come. What logging levels really mean? What do they mean, Carl?
Well, I know as a developer, sometimes you have this logging tool and you have, you know, the fatal error warn info and debug. And it's like, you know, what should I put this one as? Is it really an error? Is it a warn? But somebody just kind of like crossed off, you know, those levels and kind of put up what they really mean. So
this is awesome.
instead of log.fatal, it's wake me up at 4 a.m. on a Sunday.
Well, it's log dot. Yeah.
Yeah. And for error, it's apologize to a user and raise a ticket. So, I mean, that makes sense. Yep. You know, if there's something that affects a user, you know, definitely, you know, that's an error. Yep. For warn, it's make a note in case it happens again.
Yep.
So, and it's something happened, but not too big. Info, everything is fine and just checking in.
Yep.
And log.debug is fill my C drive with a stack traces.
This is so good because I believe that I have actually written a blog post on the same thing. And I've seen other articles talk about this. And when I saw it in here, I'm like, really, Carl? Really? We're doing this again? but this is perfect because it's just this one picture and it's perfect. I'll just leave it at that.
I like it.
Yeah. List of internet top level domains.
Yeah. So I was on a random Slack channel talking with somebody and they were wondering if like a certain TLD existed. So I found out on Wikipedia, they have a list of everything. When I have everything, I mean, there is way more than I even thought. I mean, I knew that there is, you know, all the country codes, which there's, you know, 200 ish of, and all the new branded ones, which there are a ton of, but there's like a lot of other ones that I didn't even think of.
Dot cancer research.
Oh Lord.
Dot Catholic. Dot CEO. Yeah.
And what's really interesting on some of these is like some of the notes that there are like dot pharmacy. It says to like even get it, you have to like prove that in the country where you're stationed that you have what it legally takes to run and distribute, you know, pharmaceuticals. Yeah. And I'm like, wow.
There's dot duck.
I mean,
okay. What's the craziest one in here?
I mean, there's some that are for other languages.
GOP.
There's like a lot of .xn dashes, and yeah. I don't really know what those for, but you know, those are a lot of times for other foreign character sets.
Yeah. Dot HIV.
Oh, nice.
That's got to be super fun. Dot Kim. Oh, that's cool. We need a dot Jason. Is there a Jason in there?
There's the dot socks. I think that's what you're looking for.
Yeah, thanks.
Well, the one I'm interested in is dot KE.
Is there dot smartass?
I'm interested in dot KE. My son sent me an email going, hey, Dad, the dot KE domain is about to come. And I'm like, dot KE, why do I care about dot KE? And he's like, because it's the last two letters of your name. And so you can kind of have, you know, you can essentially make your name by picking the last two letters and adding to it. So
yeah. Anyway,
and then some of the ones I wasn't aware of, like there's a .Microsoft, you know, .Yahoo. So I mean, like, just business names are taken up as TLDs.
So what would you use .Microsoft for? It would be like us.Microsoft. store.Microsoft. That'd be interesting. Yeah. I don't know. I think .com is still king, right? But I always thought it's king.
Yeah. But there's certain, you know, nice ways to brand yourself with some of these other ones.
Yep. Okay, I gotta start looking at this. Oh yeah, there is the .ke is Kenya.
Yeah, it's apparently about to come out. So.
Yeah. Okay, let's move on. We dwelled on that one way too long. NetDuino is back. I didn't know it was gone.
I didn't know it was gone either, but it's nice to know that it's back now. Okay. I mean, for those who don't know, NetDuino was an Arduino hardware that you could write .NET code on, and it understood it natively. So you could have same pinouts, you could use the same shields and stuff that an Arduino has, but you can write your .NET code directly on that. And now that it's back, it also comes with full Mac OS support. So if you have a Mac and you want to write .NET code that runs on this NetDuino, you can do that too. So that's why I thought that made this extra awesome. And not only that, but it's also in stock. So a lot of times when stuff like this happens, they sell out immediately of kits like this, but they're out on Amazon.
Okay. That's really cool.
Awesome.
I like it. I already have too many IoT devices, otherwise I'd get one.
Yeah.
What we've learned from .NET Core SDK telemetry.
I thought this one was interesting because, you know, first and foremost, a lot of us as developers forget that telemetry is always being collected on us. I mean, even though we do that in our products for other people, we got to remember that the tools that we use are doing this too. Mm-hmm. But what's really cool is they've opened this back up and shared some of the interesting things up,
which is great.
And now that .NET Core also runs on alternate platforms other than just Windows, you can see how people use it differently on Mac OS X or on Linux. So I think, like, if you look like halfway down, there's some three side by side charts that show the top commands run in .NET Core. So you could see, like, in OS X, the top three are restore, build, and run.
Yeah.
On Linux, it's run, restore, build. And on Windows, it's build, test, and restore.
That's interesting. I suppose the test makes sense, right? Because you're probably converting something and trying to run your tests. Build, run. Okay, that's interesting. That's super interesting. Yeah, and obviously this telemetry is super helpful for figuring out, like, you know, what to focus on and bugs and things like that. So yeah, it's great to see. So let's talk to James about Fluent Design, because there was, this was rolled out at Build, and we just haven't had a chance to talk about it yet. So really glad you're able to come on here. So I guess we should start with, what is Fluent Design?
Yeah, that's a really good question. Well, you know, when we started to talk about this at Build, we really sort of set the context by talking about a couple of the shifts that we've been seeing, you know, out there that really motivated us to go think about Fluent. And really the two big trends were, the first one was this notion of ubiquitous computing. And this is really where, if you kind of look at the devices that we tend to use in our lives, it's no longer just the one. It's no longer just I've got my phone or I've got my laptop, but it's really this notion of a kind of a constellation of devices. Mm-hmm. And really the sort of computing fades into the background. And depending on what you're doing at any moment, you sort of grab the nearest device that is most appropriate for the task at hand. And the challenge with that world is that, you know, the diversity of form factors is really exploding. And, you know, obviously the mobile era, you know, caused a great deal of innovation to occur. But we're now seeing kind of, you know, huge screen devices. We're now seeing, you know, devices with all sorts of different input modalities. And, you know, obviously the big shift that's on the horizon is augmented reality, AR, VR, MR, those kind of star R kind of technologies where, you know, we're really, you know, looking at a very different paradigms for interaction. And so ubiquitous computing is definitely something that, you know, Microsoft takes very seriously, you know, across the entire company, because it touches all of it. And it's something Satya talks about a lot. And so that was definitely one big shift that we wanted to kind of really consider when we look at how we want to evolve the software and the interfaces to really match that task and match, user expectations. The second big shift is really something that we think of in terms of creativity and just that the reigniting of creativity. And what we see is that really, you know, the young people of today are born creative. Like as they start to use their devices, the things that they do with them is really wanting to create, wanting to express themselves, wanting to introduce emotion, and just the notion of how storytelling sort of weaves into more and more of what we do and so on. And so we, you know, really as we took a step back, we saw those two big shifts and big trends as being, you know, real motivators for how we wanted to think about reimagining the design language. And then if you sort of look at what went before, you know, really what went before was something that from a Microsoft perspective was where it was very sort of born out of that small screen mobile era. It was very flat, very two-dimensional. We talked about digitally authentic and stuff. And we really felt that it was time to evolve that forward to something that was much more multidimensional, much more immersive in nature. You know, from an input modality perspective, there was a big focus on touch. And so having bigger hit targets, those kind of things, as really the primary input modality. But now it's very clear that, as we were saying, you know, with ubiquitous computing, different input modalities, we've really got to be much more multimodal in how we expect to handle input, as well as, I think, supporting not only the notion of consumption, but also creation. You know, the design language, again, that was from this mobile era was very much, how do you consume? Now, how do we create? How do we really go target that? And so really it's, you know, a series of trends and shifts that have really caused us to go reimagine how we tackle and how we approach this design language.
Yeah, so I'm thinking about this thought process, right? So like you mentioned, you know, like HoloLens comes out and you're sort of, the first thing you kind of ask yourself is like, okay, like what should this stuff look like, right? And just like any other company, you know, the partners I work with, they always, you know, the big thing that comes up is I need something that will run on-prem and something in the cloud. And guess what? We really don't want to write all our code twice. This kind of sounds like something similar. And it seems like there's a lot of advantage, you know, like you guys did it in such a way that there's a ton of advantages, but it seems like one of the first things that you ran into was just, hey, we just need, we just need like some kind of UI that people can understand, and it has to be the same across these things so that people don't get confused. Is that legitimate?
Yeah, kind of. I mean, I think when we think about Fluent, we think about Fluent as a design system, you know, as much as anything else. And so it's really how we go and approach solving some of the problems that come up. Yeah. The other big part of Fluent is that, you know, it isn't a thing where Microsoft's going to go off, you know, for 5 years in a very dark room and come out with this thing, here it is. We think that, you know, a more modern approach to that is really to establish some guiding principles, but to be much more incremental in how we go to tackle and deliver it, because we want to be more agile. We want to take user feedback into account, and hence to really sort of approach this in a series of waves, you know, will really help to get stuff into people's hands. So from the perspective of it being a system, you know, it wasn't really a case of having to solve all of the problems, you know, all at once today, but to pick some, like, so, you know, one example where we were trying to kind of harmonize the language across HoloLens, across other devices, was the notion of focus. And typically in all of these systems, there's some kind of focus that you need. You know, what are you actually trying to click on? You're trying to click on a button. And if you're doing that with touch, then it's a direct manipulation. You can touch down directly on it. But if you're using mouse, if you're using pen, and indeed, if you're using kind of a mixed reality device, you need some other notion of how do I actually tell the system what I'm clicking on? And so this was a great example where this notion of the reveal highlight treatment came out. And this is where we wanted to sort of use the notion of light as a way of focusing the eye and being able to disambiguate, you know, do I mean this button or that button? And the really nice thing with using light is it works really, really well in an immersive environment, because, you know, you may have seen those examples of sort of the gaze tracking and sort of light rays that show you where you're looking. And so if you've got like a virtual reality headset versus mixed reality, you know, there are different specific ways that these devices will express that. But from a design treatment perspective, you know, you get to sort of design it once and have it be this this, it just makes sense in all of those places. And so I think that's an example where we haven't necessarily got a system for all of this yet, but we do have some of the principles. And you know, so as we move forward through the waves, we'll get to that point where we do have something that makes sense across the devices.
Don't wait for users to report problems. Raygun gives you complete visibility on errors, crashes, and performance problems affecting your end users. Replicate issues in seconds rather than digging through log files or having to rely on users to report errors or crashes. Raygun gives you a window into how users are really experiencing your software applications, supports all major programming languages and platforms, and integrates with your current development workflow tools too. There's a free 14-day trial, and it takes minutes to implement. So start resolving issues in your application and check it out today at raygun.com. So, you know, I remember when kind of Metro or Modern Design Language, you know, whatever Microsoft like renamed it to in the middle and never told us, there was a lot of stuff that was very prescriptive guidance with that. Like, this is how live tile should look, and this is what padding should look like. And there's a lot of very specific ways to use color and stuff like that. And then later on, kind of like, you know, the WinRT era came off with MDL2. And then there was like very minimal guidance, like kind of do whatever you want. Does Microsoft have any kind of, you know, guidance for developers, for designers in using Fluent Design, or is that something that's still, you know, Microsoft is feeling out?
That's a really, really good question. And I think that really comes back to the sort of notion of this being a system. We wanted to build it as a system from the get-go. And so I think, you know, the elements we see as being necessary to have a system is really, you know, first of all, the platform itself, which is, what are the APIs, you know, what are the controls and so on? What are the features that help me get this? The second piece, which we think is as important, is the guidelines. And so there is actually a great guideline site that we came out with. And if you go to fluent.microsoft.com, that's a great redirect out to all the resources. And so, you know, put a lot of energy into the guidelines up front. So, specific answer is yes. And I think the other thing we want to do is have the guidelines be, you know, responsive to how developers interpret them and so on. So there's actually, you know, it's pretty much a place where developers can actually go comment on the guidelines, and we can have a discussion with developers and designers there to really sort of understand, are these making sense? Do we need to tweak them? Whilst also being able to sort of declare them up front as really part of this wave one of things. But beyond that, we also need things like tools and samples, and we want to build a great community around Fluent as well, because that will be a big part in its success, we believe. So, absolutely.
So you mentioned you also mentioned that like light was one of the main kind of guiding concepts or features of Fluent Design. What are some of the other ones that are in there?
Yeah, sure. So I think we announced 5, and you know, I'll now try and remember the 5 because I'm on the spot. Pop quiz. But yeah, I mean, light is one of the big ones, and that's also one of the big ones that we're focusing on in wave one. Some of the other ones, sort of depth is a big one. And we can sort of drill into these a little bit more if we want to. Motion is another big one, and that's, you know, probably won't be that surprising for those listeners that have been following along with some of what we've been doing in the sort of Windows UI composition work over the last few releases. Scale is another one, and scale really, you know, has multiple meanings to it, but it's really the primary idea there is scaling from an input and an output perspective. So different screen sizes, small to large, different dimensions. You know, we talk about this notion of 0D. So, I mean, if you think about your Alexa or your Harman Kardon or whatever it may be device, you know, these things don't have an output at all, but they do have an input. And so, you know, we think of that as a 0D, and then all the way up to 3D with mixed reality. So scaling across input, scaling across output. And now I'm spacing on the last one. I may have
starts with an M.
I think it material. I think it is
material. How could I forget material? How could I forget material? One of my favorite ones. So yeah, material. And this, you know, we did a lot to really shift the industry when, if you remember, skeuomorphism, which was sort of, you know, very popular at one point and became a very extreme form of expression in UX. And the reaction to that was sort of this very flat, what we call authentically digital kind of treatments. And I think that we recognize that to bring emotion back and to bring that sort of slight softening that we love so much. And, you know, you look at a photograph and it has that sort of depth of field effect, and that's pleasing to us. And so how can we bring back some of that materiality, but without being too kind of, trying to be skeuomorphic about things?
So I think right now the first material is acrylic. So the next one is like Alcantara.
Yeah, well, it's funny. I was doing a talk last week in Las Vegas, and I was showing off a tool that we've been putting together called Material Designer. And the people that have been playing around with this came up with this gold material that looked rather nice. And I felt, because I was in Vegas, I had to show gold. And how cool that was. Yeah, Alcantara definitely... I have some right in front of me, and I
as I say, have you Carl, this is totally a tangent, but have you seen the new Surface laptop in person, Carl?
No, not the laptop. James.
So I saw one in person. What's interesting, the feel, since we're speaking of material, the feel of the trackpad, for whatever, it feels better than on the Surface Book, which I found kind of interesting. Is that what you have right there, James?
I've got the new Pro just down here on the desk. I love it. I'm going to sound like a shill now, because I do love it to pieces.
Yeah.
You're
biased, sellout.
I'm biased. I'm very
drinking
biased.
The Kool-Aid.
I'm drinking the Kool-Aid. But yeah, I mean, I do love it. And I'm finding myself using the pen more and more. I love the battery. Yeah, I mean, it's just, it's a nice device. And again, you know, coming back to the notion of emotion, I do find sort of an emotional connection a little bit, which may sound creepy, but I think and a big part of that does come from the attention to detail and the materials and sort of the, you know, how it feels in the hand, not necessarily just, oh, it looks nice or whatever. So I think we want to bring that, you know, we want to bring that into the design language and have emotion be something that's important. We really want users of apps to love using the apps and choose to use them, and therefore we want to have that built into the language.
And I think one thing to note, like, especially with material and acrylic in particular, is, you know, some of the things that you guys seem to be working on is not just making it look beautiful, but being able to and run everywhere, but make sure it runs efficiently everywhere too.
Yes.
Because as I was working with acrylic, I noticed you can't do the old school Aero effect where you have like 30 tinted windows and you make them all blur all the way down to the desktop. You can't do that. As soon as you're not the number one guy anymore, you're out of focus, you switch that and you don't get the acrylic effect anymore. And yeah. I'm assuming that's a performance piece too.
Yes, it is. And I mean, that's a fantastic point that you bring up here. And so, we want to sort of push the system and leverage the GPU and leverage the capabilities. But at the same time, we don't want the battery to sort of die in an hour because we're so busy doing these insane effects that the battery dies. And so what we've done is we've really, and we sort of talk about this notion of possible, easy, and default. And if you take the material the acrylic material as an example, it's a great sort of progression. You know, what we did back, I guess it was in sort of TH2 RS1 timeframe, the anniversary update and subsequently in the creators update, was we introduced new effects capabilities in the system. You know, some of the primitive things like blurs and shaders and being able to build up these effects graphs. And then as we move forward, we started to, you know, we shipped a library where, you know, if you wanted to get sort of a kind of canonical blur effect, there was an open source project and it used some of the ingredients of acrylic, but we didn't talk about it as a material. It was really just a series of effects. And then as we bring out Fluent, we sort of actually make this the default and we bake it into a bunch of the new controls. And as part of that sort of final process of making it default, one of the key aspects is to sort of introduce the necessary system policy that will guarantee things like battery life. And so if you go and use the raw low-level effects, you know, they will never disable and they're sort of essentially what you use is what you get. But if you use the controls and the styles that we have in XAML, then you do get this policy behavior and that's where those things kick in. So it's a very deliberate progression, and you're going to see that as we introduce things like springs, like one of the things that we're doing in the full creators update, and we'll talk about motion and more detail, but you know, we're introducing that and making that possible in the composition system. And then as we roll out the waves of Fluent, we'll figure out what does it mean to have these this more of these physics components, and then how do we build them in by default?
So I just want to pause for a bit and see if I understand something correctly. So by these policies, what you're saying is, you know, if maybe I'm on a mobile device on my laptop and my battery's getting low, the operating system might disable the effects for my application in order to save battery. Is that the case?
Yes. So we, yeah, there's really that is the case. So we do already have this notion of a battery saver. And so, again, if you're using the kind of the styles that we define, some of the acrylic mm-hmm. styles that are new, you will get that notion of the style will turn off when battery saver kicks in. And then, you know, the other aspect of policy is, you know, we have a policy, which is your, if your foreground window loses focus and goes to the background, we will remove some of those more expensive acrylic treatments to save battery as well. And so there's a secondary reason, which is this notion of if you have the too many layers of transparency, it becomes very confusing. And I think that was kind of a criticism when we were using these effects back in the sort of Windows 7 era was, you know, you get these weird effects where you can't really tell what's active because all the title bars are see-through and so on. And, and so, I mean, I guess there's a policy relating to battery and there's a policy relating to what we think is best for the user in terms of getting confused if there's too much of that. So we think of all of this as policy in a nutshell.
Yeah, I've actually used that to my advantage before. So I make my command prompt semi-transparent, and then you can actually put it over like a web page or something else, and it's noisy, but you can still read the web page and like the and what's going on in the command prompt.
Yes.
And people probably think I'm insane, but there's some times when it actually makes sense and you can do that.
Yes.
It's pretty cool.
Yeah. So I mean, this is where, you know, we want to try and have the policy be the default, the policy be the sort of majority case.
Right.
But if you want to sort of drill in and get the more sort of out there things, that's the whole notion of possible. And that's where having this sort of nicely layered system really lends itself to that, that approach, hopefully. Yeah. So materials are awesome. And yeah, I mean, acrylic is really the one that you'll see a lot. And I think, you know, another aspect that's been really important with Fluent is to make sure that we really get broad adoption inside of Microsoft. And so if you sort of follow along with some of the enthusiast sites I do, because I'm an enthusiast, I'm, again, ashamed to admit this, but you will see that, you know, as we push out updates to the various inbox apps, they're starting to get the acrylic capability and they're starting to really adopt the Fluent design system. And so we hope that by putting out a lot of usage of this will really sort of lead the way with developers and also lead the way with delighting users with it as well.
Yeah. So I noticed this might be a stupid question, but my calculator looks different. Like, is that using this?
It is. Yeah.
Okay.
Calculator is actually
I was like, cause I just noticed it today and I'm like, am I losing my mind or is this using some of the new stuff?
Yeah, no, it is. It's actually in the builds, and I've just opened up a calculator instance on my desk.
So it's semi-transparent, like to the point where it's not. It's just like it's like the perfect amount, and whenever you hover over things and kind of move around, I mean, it just has a really like, and it just feels good.
Yeah, it does, and it's funny because again, I sort of joke about this, but there's a serious point here where, you know, part of having, you know, delightful experiences is just these little subtle touches, which, you know, will serve some level of purpose. And we do want what we do to be purposeful. But there's another element that's really just trying to make it more delightful. And so, you know, as I hover over the calculator, I see this reveal highlight and I see this kind of, you know, materiality that is definitely pleasing to me. And I've got, you know, a sort of a rich sunset on my desktop right now. And I can just sort of see that thing that I've selected as a user is something that's important to me. I can sort of see that bleed through a little bit. And
yeah, that's cool. It looks cool.
I know this is something that Jason and I have talked about. You know, in our offices, we've discovered that as we have multiple light sources, it makes our offices feel more comfortable. And to me, it seems like with this Fluent design system, that just, you know, it might not be a, you know, the one detail itself that really makes it feel a lot more polished, but it's all the little things once they add up make the whole thing feel better.
They do. They definitely do. And I think, you know, craftsmanship is something we really care about. And it's not only in how we do the design language, but it's also in how we we want to make all of the little things as good as possible. And if there are problems with the little things also, you know, no thing should be too little, really. And so I think that's definitely another trend I've seen, you know, in the time I've been in Windows and in recent years, is something that we really take a lot of pride and a lot of care goes into that. So, yeah, I mean, that's absolutely a deliberate thing.
So why is this called Fluent? This might be a stupid question.
Oh, Lordy, that's a good one.
is it some inside secret that you're not allowed to tell us?
Well, yeah, I think that to answer that, I would actually go and open up fluent.microsoft.com because you know, our wonderful design VP Albert Shum has written a great sort of treatise on why Fluent, and I'm going to do an appallingly bad job.
Oh, okay, I got you.
Trying to tell you.
Yeah.
Why we came up with that. But, you know, we were looking for a name, and I think we wanted to come up with a name that we decided on up front this time, because clearly it really helps to have that as be a deliberate thing. And, you know, there was all sorts of choice and debate, and, you know, ultimately I didn't have a lot of insight into what finally kind of caused that. But
I gotcha. It's a name.
Yeah, I mean, it says an eloquent design system for a complex world. You know, it's time for a bold, scalable universal design.
Yeah, so, I was actually wondering if it had something to do with the code, because the only place that I know the Fluent name from is kind of like this chaining of commands, and, you know, I wasn't sure if it had anything to do with that or not. So,
no, I think it was really, you know, a blend of something that sounded appropriate, that sounded future, that you know, there's all sorts of issues around trademarking and other things which. Yep. I have no visibility into it. I think it's a complex sort of pivot amongst many inputs. But I like it a lot, and I really like being able to talk about something that has an identifiable name, and, you know, that also is something that people are kind of seem to be receiving in a positive way. It's nice as well. Yep.
So as a developer, am I going to have to learn new APIs, new SDKs, or does this kind of build on maybe some of the existing composition APIs that I'm used to dealing with?
Yeah, that's a really, really good question. And so, you know, the answer is no, there's nothing net new to learn. However, you know, we are introducing new controls. And so one of the things that we want to really help developers with is just standardizing things that should be standardized. And so one of the primary things that is important in an app is its sort of structure, its information architecture, it's how do you navigate around the place. And so we've taken the opportunity this release to release a new navigation view control. And that is, so it's a net new control that you have to learn. However, it's only about, you know, 10-ish lines of XAML to bring one of these things into your app. And if you do that, a lot, you essentially get a lot of stuff for free. So you get things like the acrylic material, you get things like the, you know, the reveal highlight effect, you get things like an adaptive responsive control that can adapt to the form factor of the device, and has all of the adaptive state triggers necessary. And it brings a level of standardization that users will be familiar. And in fact, it's what a lot of our first party apps are using that want this navigation pattern. And so, you know, what we say is if developers use the built-in controls, then they'll definitely get the best experience. And because they're the built-in controls, hopefully they're familiar and it's not a new concept. Some of the styling that we talked about is done through styles. And so now you don't have to drop down to the composition layer if you want to apply acrylic material. So what you do instead is to take a brush called, you know, and there's a series of them, all, you know, called acrylic system brush with different weights, different styles. You throw that into any region of your app, you know, that accepts a brush, and that could be on a rectangle, could be on a grid, anywhere where a brush plugs in, and you will get that acrylic material. And so we've really tried to bring up the ease of use here and really make it work as you as a XAML developer would expect and be completely familiar. Now, if you want to go off the reservation and play and customize, then absolutely you can drop down and do that in composition as well. So we built the composition stack in TH2 and beyond, you know, specifically to allow this evolution. And so it's sort of a continuum, if you like, to use another word.
And then I'm assuming that in addition to the new controls that you've given us, you've updated the existing ones, like the reveal highlight on a button, for example.
Correct. So there's a set of, and I think we talked about this at Build in terms of the specific controls that get the specific features, but things like if you've got toolbars, things like if you've got list views, you'll get the reveal highlight. And it's also theme adaptive. So, you know, if your app is a dark themed app or a light themed app, if you offer the user the ability to switch over between those two themes, you will get the reveal highlight and you'll get the right version that matches the theme. So, yeah, I mean, absolutely. And you know, we're only just getting started with this. You know, we really want to go a lot further than in the future.
Yeah, say it with me, more dark themes. More dark themes.
Darkness.
Yeah, I want to be dark. In the darkness. Actually, the only issue I have with that, like I use the dark theme on everything. The issue I have with it is if I'm in the sun, yeah, you can't read anything. I have to sit there and switch all the themes over so that I can actually see my screen. Which is pretty terrible. So, you know, if I'm a developer and not a designer, like, is this just more ammo to like shoot myself in the foot or, you know, is this going to be better for me? I mean, are my apps just going to sort of look a little bit better and, you know, I can just kind of call it a day from that standpoint?
It's always a tricky one being a developer and thinking about design and UI, because, you know, if you're a one man shop, it may not be a skill you have. And so what do you even do about designing apps? And this is why we want you to try and, you know, we want the piss of success to be the thing you fall into. And hopefully you don't shoot yourself in the foot, you know, by just doing the default sets of things. It's definitely a case where if you get overzealous with how you apply it, you know, just like, you know, the canonical example of this is the blink tag. And there are many other, you know, there
I
are
would
many
say
other
animations in general, right? It's just like
animations.
Yeah,
in
I'm
general.
Gonna have. I remember I was using Ubuntu years ago, and like I set it up, the whenever I close a window, like it would go up in flames, you know. And this is like flames, like flame all the things, and it looks so freaking cool. But yeah, that wasn't actually cool.
you can get overload, and I mean, you know, one example that I'll give a specific example around is drop shadows, and. Mm-hmm. Drop shadows is something that we've enabled in the possible level. We haven't yet delivered the system for it. We've talked about how we want to do more with Z-Depth in wave two of Fluent. And we definitely do have plans to systematize it. But today, you know, it's very easy to sort of take drop shadows and go nuts with them to the extent that, you know, you shoot yourself in the foot both now and in the future when we bring the system there and suddenly there's like two different types of drop shadows appearing.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, it is a bit of a fine line. And I think, you know, with anything that is sort of design and aesthetic, it sort of depends where you're coming from as to, you know, how much of a problem that'll be. But I think when done right, you know, to sort of take drop shadows and spin them positively, if you look at what they've done with them in the recent OneNote update, I don't know if you've had a chance to look at that.
I'm looking at it right now.
It's the UWP OneNote.
That one. Okay.
Which has actually become incredible, and I've actually switched personally because I love. They've also got some nice physics animations and things in there.
I might have to look at that again.
Yeah, you should definitely give it a little look. But you know, when you expand out your sort of the notebook tabs, not only do you get this nice animation, but they've used a really nice treatment for shadows, and so, you know, that probably took a designer. If I were to try and jam in a bunch of shadows where we don't have a system yet in place, I might, you know, easily shoot myself in the foot. And so, yeah, I mean, I think we want to make the common case stuff as easy as possible, but also by providing the power, there is that ability to shoot yourself in the foot as well. So, you know, you have to be a little bit careful.
Dang, this is cool.
Nice.
This is fun.
What about that physics stuff going on as you expand?
Yeah, it's kind of springy, but not
springy. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, as an app developer, you know, I have some beliefs that might not be held in fact. So, you know, I want to believe that if I make my app better looking, that I'll make more money in the long run. Is there any kind of evidence that if I do this, either maybe not money, but, you know, more downloads or stuff like that? Is there any evidence that Microsoft has that, you know, by making better apps in the design way, that I will achieve other metrics?
Yes. Well, it's something where we're working to put together some case studies on this, because we do have both empirical and anecdotal evidence that show that when you consider the user experience as a core part of your app, not just the functionality, but just, you know, how user experience works and really focus on making it better, that you do, you know, things that go up are things like engagement. So the amount of time a user spends in your app will go up. The stickiness, coming back to your app, using your app in preference to another app. And, you know, imagine two apps that have equivalent or similar functionality. If there's one that has a nicer, more delightful, more engaging experience, there's definitely evidence that we see. What we haven't yet done is to actually publish this formally out, but we're definitely working on putting together, you know, a series of case studies around this, because, you know, it's not only true of what we do at Microsoft, it's true across the board. And I know, you know, both Apple and Google have talked about this in their blogs about how, you know, an equivalent app with this attention and an application of the UI patterns of the platform will make you more money. So it's definitely the case. And we will definitely be talking about that more as we, you know, put these these case studies together.
Aspose offers a powerful set of file management APIs with which developers can create applications, which can create, open, edit, and save the majority of popular business file formats. Their product range supports a multitude of file formats, including Word documents, Excel spreadsheets, PowerPoint presentations, PDF documents, OneNote, Outlook, Project, Visio files, popular image formats, and many others. Aspose produces APIs for .NET, Java, and the cloud, which can be utilized in almost any modern language available today. Visit Aspose.com for a free 30-day no-limitations trial, and if you get stuck, message the friendly support team for help. All technical support is offered free of charge. And remember, if you are lucky winner, you will receive a free developer small business license for Aspose.net, a powerful toolkit for working with Word documents in your applications.
My new notebook is syncing here. thinking about the perspective of the user and the developer, like, I guess my first question is, does this make the user more productive? Like, you know, I actually kind of liked it when we switched to this flat design, because it was very utilitarian. It's just like, everything will be flat, you will be efficient, and like, we don't need to get all fancy. You know, we were talking like this new one, like it feels good. So like, you know, I like it. But when I'm looking at it here, it doesn't look like I'm really sacrificing anything, because the stuff is bouncing around kind of in a logical way.
Yes.
But are we gaining anything as far as productivity for the user?
Well, I think that, you know, the flat design system that we had before, again, you know, one of the challenges with it was that because it was sort of primarily designed for consumption, it didn't really work that well in more productivity focused apps. And so, you know, we saw this internally when apps like Office and others were trying to apply it. You know, if you've got very dense commanding surfaces and lots of nested toolbars and all these other things, that previous design language started to fall apart a little bit. And that's why it was very challenging to update parts of the system with it. And so I think some of the aspects of Fluent are deliberately designed to address some of those productivity things. Like, you know, how do you disambiguate if you've got a toolbar with a lot of density and you may have multiple toolbars? You know, you can draw lots of lines all over the UI, which is sort of the old way. But by using the lighting and the hover effect, not only is that sort of consistent across devices, but it also helps as you're actually trying to do the task at hand, figure out where am I, what am I clicking on. And so we definitely want Fluent to not only be something that is a sort of, you know, aesthetically pleasing environment, but we want these things to be rooted in direct user benefit. And, you know, some materials and acrylic, we want to use that to try and build up a hierarchy so you can separate the app out and clearly partition the information architecture and things. And, you know, with depth, again, separating out what aspects are relevant now. Like if you're doing some sort of modal experience, depth helps to separate that contextually away from the rest of the app. So it's definitely an intent to have this be stuff that matters and helps users, not just is sort of pretty eye candy.
So,
and you may be skeptical, so.
It's funny because are you trying the new one, Carl?
Yes. Okay. In fact, I switched over to it. I closed.
Yeah,
I did too.
Same here. So,
it's funny. No, because I see that there's three people on the current page, you know, for the show notes, and it's Carl, and Jason. So, I think Carl just hasn't updated that he closed the other one, but he did the same thing I did. So we're both in the new one. So if it fails, I blame you.
Well, so there's a guy on Twitter called Master Dewey, who is the product manager for OneNote. And he basically says, if there is a single reason why you can't use this modern one, he wants to know about it. Oh. Because they really want people to switch to it. They believe that it's the future and, you know, so on and so forth.
Yeah, it used to be way behind. Like, it's come a long way. So I guess anybody who's listening, like, I was skeptical. But I opened it up and, even I think the layout is actually better as far as like the toolbar.
Yeah.
It just seems like a more efficient use of space, but it looks like it's still good for touch.
Yes.
So yeah, I mean, I'll just,
and it's got amazing inking support using Direct Ink, which is our new ink stack that the old OneNote didn't use. So, I mean, there is definitely for me a bit of a poster child that's cutting, you know, it's really proving that we have a viable platform and you can build amazing experiences. And it's just great to see a team that's willing to really push and advance the app.
I'm sold.
Excellent.
Yeah. So I know we weren't going to talk about this, but can he also be put in charge of the Skype app now?
Oh, Lord.
Moving on.
Well, well, you know what's funny about what you just said is the Skype app I'm using on my desktop is the universal one. I'm not using the desktop one, and I've actually switched to that one, and I love it. You know, it's finally got.
Is that the new one then?
That's not the new one. So I don't believe that the.
So there's a desktop, a UWP, and then there's a new one.
Well, no. So that's sorry. There's two different things here. One is there's this sort of refresh that's happened. To the iOS and Android Skype apps, and I think that's what Carl's referring to. Maybe mm-hmm.
Am
I
wrong? Oh, really? Okay. Yes. I honestly haven't opened in a while. I'll have to do that.
Yeah, please don't.
I'm not touching that one because I think that the team is listening to the feedback. Is what I'll say there.
Oh yeah, look at that! It's like a squiggly line.
It's got a squiggly line and all this stuff. So that hasn't happened in the one I'm using, and I can't speak to. I don't know what the plans are there.
I have to choose a theme. Swipe.
Yeah, it's.
So while Jason's playing with that, you know, is there anything you could tell us about what's going to be coming up in the Fall Creators Update and maybe even beyond with Fluent Design and what we're going to see as developers?
Sure. Yeah. So, I mean, I think, you know, the Wave 1 features that are kind of lighting up in the UI platform in XAML itself are specifically reveal highlight, the acrylic material, connected animations, conscious controls, and perspective parallax. And so each of those things that I just mentioned is a specific thing that's it's either control or a style or something that you get to in XAML that, you know, has a distinct set of value and a distinct set of purposes. There's a set of new things coming in the composition layer as well. There's as I mentioned, you know, sort of got physics-based animations. We're tweaking and adding more effects and, you know, doing some work in the animation system, you know, across the board there. So, you know, we'll obviously be talking about that and blogging about it more. There's some great new interop stuff that we're doing where some of the composition effects actually can be done from XAML directly. So we have a new XAML effect brush where you can basically build a custom effect brush using, you know, essentially something rooted in XAML, not having to drop down to the composition layer.
Nice.
We have another thing called a pointer position property set. And this is actually how reveal highlight works, is we have this ability to bind the cursor position to an effect in some way so that effect can follow the cursor. So, you know, we've talked about this at build. We'll talk about it more as it rolls out. The SDKs are starting to kind of roll out now for people to play with it. So that's some of the stuff we're shipping in the Fall Creators Update. Beyond that, there's I think the things we talked about at build was 360 media playback that's coming, built in to the system, more conscious controls. So conscious controls is this notion of, like, if you think of a scroll viewer, if you're using a mouse, then it's really nice to have a scroll bar that you can pick up and grab, and that's what users are familiar with. That's what we've been shipping since, you know, probably 1995 or before then. But as you start to have these new input modalities like touch and ink and pen and others, you don't actually need that great big sliver of your UI to sort of have this dirty great scroll bar there. So why not have the UI actually understand what input you're using and respond to it? And so with conscious scrolling, we have the conscious that thing. With conscious headers, it's this notion of, in my app, I have a sort of a header region it may be some hero content, like you go and look at an album and it's the album art or whatever. But as you scroll through the tracks, now I'm looking at the tracks. I don't, that header is less important now. And so conscious headers allows that to kind of collapse away automatically and allow the user to focus on the actual content itself. That's another example where this stuff can help usability, because, you know, it isn't, again, just you can have the pretty header, but when the user is interacting with the content, you want to see the content. So get the header out of the way for me. I'm sort of rabbiting through this list now. Tell me if I'm going too quickly.
No, it's good.
Speech is another thing that, you know, we really want to make a first-class citizen even more than it is today. And so have speech light up in new places. Also have ink light up in new places, and things like, you know, direct editing of ink in text boxes and things like that. Hmm. And then another big one, which I kind of mentioned earlier, is the sort of Z depth scaling and sort of thinking about how do we actually stack things in Z and how does that work when it's in augmented reality versus when it's kind of on the desktop and things like that. We'll be working on more materials. It probably won't be gold. It probably won't be Alcantara, sadly, but I'll probably build my own version of that because I want it. But there'll be more work with materials, and making materials more dynamic than they are now as well is another area. So, you know, we've got a big pipeline of stuff, and we're doing, you know, innovations at all levels in the platform that will roll out over time that will really kind of carry this forward. And we want to have wave after wave after wave of goodness come in the platform and light up in the first party apps and then in the SDKs as well. So yeah, there's lots coming.
So for build in all of your demos for to show off what originally was in Fluent Design, I notice it's up on GitHub now. You had built something called Buildcast. So github.com/microsoft/buildcast.
Yes.
And we must thank you because you have us right there in a screenshot on that page. So,
we like it. Yes.
Can I assume that as Fluent Design evolves and you add more, that this will be updated to show all of those new concepts as well?
Yes, absolutely. And this is something that, you know, we felt that to really deliver this meaningfully for developers, it's great to have first-party apps adopt the characteristics and aspects of Fluent. And you can go and, as a developer, see that and say, "How I want to do that in my app now." But we also felt that it would be great to have a sample that was sort of more of an end-to-end sample. You know, we've shipped a whole bunch of different kind of point samples and control galleries and sample galleries. And those are really important parts of Fluent, for sure. However, we also wanted a place where you can sort of see in a semi-real app, I'll call it semi-real, like it has actual, you know, sort of functionality. You know, you can use it for watching some of the build content as well as your awesome show. So it has purpose and it isn't just, you know, like a little, you know, widget or whatever. But it is trying to use the elements of Fluent. And so we use it as a way of testing, you know, are these things working well together? You know, if you have staggering animations on a list view and you add a connected animation, does that work? And, you know, we put that in, we found bugs, we fixed the bugs. So it helps us, but it also, I think, helps developers to hopefully see these things weave together. And so, yep, it's something we definitely plan on updating as we go forward. We're really looking forward to releasing that first snap of the code really, really soon. I'm hoping that it may go out as soon as next week, which is obviously on a podcast, like, when is next week?
Well, it's always just next week.
Yeah.
If you're listening and it's not next week, then you're listening too soon.
Yeah, exactly.
it's not James' fault.
Exactly.
Should we move on?
The end of July.
Yeah,
let's move on.
Okay. As your pick of the week, I haven't had one in a while, but I have one this week, which is the nested virtualization in Azure. So this is basically, yo dog, I heard you like VMs. So I put VMs in your VM. So if you go to this post, we'll have it in the show notes. But you can go there and check it out. And there's a video in there too, where he actually installs Hyper-V within an Azure virtual machine and then create some virtual machines in there. It's kind of a weird use case. I don't know if anybody actually wants to do that. I do know that, like, one scenario, you know, historically speaking, that has been a challenge was, you know, whenever you do things like spin up a Hyper-V image to do development with like a Windows Phone image or something like that. Like you couldn't do that in a development environment in Azure because you didn't have that nested virtualization. So there's a lot of scenarios that this ends up unlocking, which is great. And then Carl, what do you have for the dev tip of the week?
Go to sharplab.io, and this is a way for you to put some code in and kind of see what it compiles to and see if you can figure out like if there's a bug or like a compiled bug or error in your code or just maybe inefficiencies. So I'm also going to include a link that just kind of shows a little bit more explanation, I guess. So you put your code on the left, and then on the right, you can see it decompiled either in C#, VB, IL, assembly, or the syntax tree. So you can see it in all those different views. And since it's using Roslyn, it can do that pretty quickly, even in a website. So I have this little link that shows, a method that returns a dynamic object. And you can see how much code it takes to just, create and assign values to a dynamic object.
Wow.
Yeah, I was gonna do an async thing. I wanted to see what that looked like in IL because I know that there's a whole bunch of magic coming on there. But yeah, this is pretty cool because it's so easy to see like what's going on behind the scenes there.
So and you can just put in the snippets of code that it takes to recreate your logic for this, and you could just really see is it this little piece right here that I'm doing?
Yeah. What is
so?
So there's a syntax. It all looks the same.
Wow, and it even has IntelliSense. That's amazing.
Yes, and it has IntelliSense. That's awesome.
Oh, did they use the, what the heck is that thing? A Monaco editor, I wonder?
Maybe that's
I bet that. It's actually pretty easy to embed
that. The code for this
is
on GitHub.
Yeah, it's probably pretty easy to, embed the Monaco editor and get all that IntelliSense. That's a pretty cool editor.
That's nice.
Oh, it'll even convert to Visual Basic.
Yeah, let's not do that.
Yeah. Well, you can go the other way. Actually, you can go, dang it. You can go F# to C#. I want to go the other way. I want to just say I'm an F# developer.
I am.
I'll just write it all in C# and then ship it in F#. Check it in that way.
I'm liking it.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. Okay, James, let's get to the game. Pick a number between 1 and 4 inclusive.
I'm going to pick 4 today.
Okay, let's see what we got here. Not that one. Okay, here we go. Would you rather always smell like you do after a weekend camping trip or always wear an orange traffic cone on your head and bike reflectors all over your clothes?
Oh, gosh. Well, orange is my favorite color, so I might have to do that because that's actually, I can see that. How long is always?
So here's the thing. I've seen some crazy stuff at the Microsoft campus. If I saw somebody with an orange traffic cone on their head and bike reflectors, I don't think there'd be like an audience. I don't think that would be that shocking to people.
No, I know. Well, the other advantage is when I'm riding my Boosted board, I'm less likely to get hit by a car. So.
That's a good point. This is probably.
And I'll be smelling sweet. So.
Yeah. Yeah. People will be like, you smell great for a guy with a cone on his head.
I'm riding a Boosted board.
Yeah. Okay. So that's your final answer?
That's my final answer. I'm going with a cone. That's my favorite color.
Carl, awesome. Pick number
3.
Number 3? Why would you pick 3? 3 is in high demand. Okay, here we go. I found a 3 that we haven't had. Would you rather be caught picking your nose on the big screen at a huge stadium or in front of all your friends in your classroom?
Oh, Lord.
This is a game for kids.
You change that to like in an open office scenario. I'd still pick on the big screen because, it's embarrassing, but nobody knows you.
Yeah, and then you could be turned into a meme.
Yeah.
Carl the meme.
Did you pick a winner?
Oh, sounds good. Okay, so James, where can people find you?
Well, on the Twitters, I am at Clark Zone, Clarke Zone, is my Twitter handle. That's kind of where I really hang out. I think if you go there, you can get to my GitHub place where I occasionally put sample code and stuff. That is where I hang.
Okay, very cool. I just want to make sure I'm following you. I am. And then obviously fluent.microsoft.com. You
fluent.microsoft.com,
which is a nice simple address. Perfect. And then Carl, where can people find you?
You can find me on Twitter at Carl Schweitzer.
You can find me at yteki.com or on Twitter at twitter.com/ytechie. So James, thank you for coming on the show and talking about Fluent Design. And also thank you for buying a boosted board, because I'm looking forward to riding with you.
Well, thanks very much for having me. It's always a pleasure. Love you guys. Listen to your show. And love it's great to be able to come on. And yeah, when are we going to race? That's what I want to know.
I had hardware issues where, I had two hardware issues. One was that I don't remember what the issue was exactly. The drives kept getting disconnected from the motherboard, and I had multiple drive failures. Actually, maybe that was the root cause of everything. I think I had multiple drive failures, but they were like failing at different times. And the storage space array was amazing, because it would just be like, oh, degraded, you know, be like, hey, like you had a drive fail, but we're still cool. And then like it would come back online. It's like repairing. And then I'd have a different one fail. And here it was because I had those Seagate drives that were just, they had like a 25% failure rate.
Yes.
And I had multiple failures. I threw all those stupid pieces of crap out. and then I switched to Western Digital. And actually now the new one I got is, because Backblaze says these are the most reliable drives according to their stats by a lot. Like these are like a 2% failure rate compared to, like, even Western Digital was like 5 or 6%.
Which one? Okay.
So this is HGSST. So I don't know. These things are.
HGST.
Whoa, you're like.
Wow. Brilliant. You're so far ahead.
Yeah. HGST. Yep. Yeah, you got way behind there.
I'm lagging like fucking.
Holy cow.
Sorry.
I think it's because you must be uploading that file. Wow.
Right now.
He's like,
that's amazing how much that bandwidth changes.
Yeah. I think he's consuming all of his upload bandwidth is the problem.
Yeah.
I love it when Skype catches up and all of a sudden you switch into like hyper speed mode. Well, anyway.
Yeah. Well, anyways,
it just did it. That was awesome.